Hello?
Hello?
Hi. Scott Carley here.
Joel Rosenberg.
Burns. Burns.
Hi, Joel.
Hi, Scott.
Hello?
Who else? Lauren?
Is it Lauren?
Somebody else
says
hello.
This is Roberta Burns from Kentucky.
Is it Laura Burns?
Roberta.
Oh, Roberta.
Hi, Roberta.
Yeah. Hello.
That's it so far?
Yeah, just a couple of us. We'll wait a few more minutes. As many of you may know, Tamara's not going to be able to join us today. She's at a meeting in D.C.
Yeah.
So I will try to facilitate as best I can.
It should be easy if there are three of us.
Yes.
I'm mostly going to listen. This is my first one, so.
Ah, well, welcome indeed. I didn't recognize your name. And many of us have been doing this for 2 years, so we actually recognize each other's voices. So you're absolutely welcome. We usually have maybe 10 to 15 people on the call, but today is a little unusual week. We have a lot of people who are in conferences that are happening this week, so we may be a rather small group.
Don just came on.
Oh, very good. Hi, Don.
Hi there. Is it just me, or is the sound a little...
Oh, no. Joel's here, and Roberta.
Hey, Don.
Yeah, well, how are you? that was only the beginning of the sentence. Is it just me, or is the sound a little weird today?
Oh.
Well, this is Martha Shaw. I'm on, too, but I'm on a mute.
So sounds okay for me, Don.
Okay.
We'll wait a few more minutes. So we can talk before we start.
How's the weather?
Good.
Hello.
Yeah, we only had 1.5 inches of rain yesterday, and then it's sunny today, so...
Where's that
global warming? Yeah. Yeah, it was another record yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
A record rainfall in Seattle?
Yep, for November the 1st.
Wow.
It's not a big deal. We break records, for rainfall all the time.
So.
Yeah.
But that's a more recent phenomena?
I guess so.
How far back the records go? 1880?
Something like that, yeah. I looked at the record one time. I think it's a good, about 130 years or so. I think on the web you can get them till about, 1920 or so, fairly easily. Well, I'm 3 minutes after the hour, so maybe we can start. Again, I'm Scott Carley at the College of Exploration in Seattle, and as I mentioned to folks earlier, Tamara Ledley, who usually leads these calls, is in Washington, D.C. at, I think it's the NSDL meeting, which is what the National, what's it called? National Science
Digital Library.
But it's also called something else, too. That's the problem.
Yes, it's the National STEM
Distributed
Library,
or whatever.
Distributed Learning.
Learning. That was it. So it the acronym stands for two things that link together. Joel, as I remember, you work a lot with the Smile Project, which is part of one of the...
Yeah, I'm working on... We're sort of wrapping up, sort of, and I've started working on energy education stuff, which is good.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, that's a nice change.
Yeah, your interest in that. I guess because there's so few of us, maybe we should go around and maybe just do a little introduction for Roberta, because this is her first call, so she at least knows who else is on the call. So I sort of introduced myself. Joel, do you want to sort of where you're from?
I'm Joel Rosenberg. I'm at UC Berkeley's Lawrence Hall of Science, and I've been sort of loosely affiliated with the Clean Pathway because we were doing SMILE, which is another NSDL pathway. around informal education, and now I've sort of gone back to my passion, which is energy education, and we're working on an after-school program for East Bay kids and trying to be very practical, green jobs, training-oriented, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So that's me.
That's great.
This is Don Dugenhaus, the Paleontological Research Institution and its Museum of the Earth in Ithaca.
This is Martha Shaw from Earth Advertising. I do a lot of PR and promotion around clean energy, and I just had an article out yesterday where I sent people to the CLN website.
Good.
David Rubel with the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality, and I do community education.
This is Karen Holweg, and I'm the past president of the North American Association for Environmental Education, and I'm dabbling on a few different climate change projects, including one here at CU in Boulder.
This is Bora Simmons, and I'm with the National Project for Excellence in Environmental Education, which is also associated with NAAEE. I'm in Eugene, Oregon.
And I'm Roberta Burns. I'm in the Kentucky Division for Air Quality, the Environmental Education Specialist here. And I'm also on the board of the Kentucky Association for Environmental Education. So I do a lot of educational outreach, and I've been doing climate education, teaching about climate change type of workshops for teachers.
Excellent. Well, Roberta, you're in the right place.
Good.
Anyone else on the call?
Caroline Lewis. I'm an education consultant. I have formal education, school principal, school teacher, and informal director of education in Botanic Gardens. And I'm looking to scale up programs that are meaningful and transformative and replicable that engage or improve civic literacy and environmental literacy. And I was at the Education Roundtable in D.C. last week or 2 weeks ago.
Right. Anyone else?
This is Jane Heinz Fry. I'm the program director for the Museum Institute for Teaching Science, and we put together professional development programs for K through 8 teachers primarily.
Great. Thanks, Jane. Anyone else? So, Roberta, I think you can get a sense that we have a pretty good cross-section of folks all around the country. So, welcome. Roberta's a new member. So, what we usually do, and I have no reason to change from that, is we spend a couple minutes just sort of going around and giving everyone a chance to announce what's happening either in their own projects and communities, anything that might be of general interest to folks around the country. So, is there any news that anyone wants to report?
Since I have election. Yeah.
We're all focused on the election, are we?
This is Karen.
Have we all voted?
This is Karen Holweg, and since I was not on the last call, I have a retrospective thing to mention. I listened for the first time to one of the phone calls by the recording of the call, and I found it very useful as a catch-up on what happened at the BC NRC meeting. My only frustration was that I couldn't ask a question.
That's why you're here.
but my take-home from listening to it, which I thought it was an excellent discussion, and thanks to all of you who were on, is that just as teachers have to assess prior conceptions and understandings of their students before they launch into a new unit or something, all those of us in informal education and working with citizens groups really have to assess beliefs of our audiences and identify trusted experts that they will listen to. And the other thing that I heard is that some underscoring of my frustration, and that is the limits of different kinds of federal grants, which are the places where the big money is for climate change education, at least as far as I know it, and the limits on communicating science, which, as the group pointed out on last week's call, is not necessarily where the action is. And the need not only to communicate other things in addition to the science, but to develop the skills to enable people to do something. So if any of you disagree with that, I'd love to hear it. Or if that's the right take-home message, then I think I got it.
Well, this is Caroline, and I was pretty much involved in that conversation last week, Karen, and I think you just summarized it perfectly. It really is about meeting people where they are, trying to fund things that are not all or nothing science investigations, but rather, you know, where the rubber meets the road with groups and communities and like-minded people. So I think I was very heartened by the DC conference and the fact that there were lots of people using change agents within communities to mobilize groups that are sort of on the fringe. But I did also respect Frank Nepo's frustration with, all right, so we've been talking about this stuff now. What next? Where is the movement? Where is the federal government stepping up to the plate? Where is the firm outcomes from these things? Because the meeting was not a consensus-building meeting. It was a fleshing out of ideas and a sharing of best practices kind of thing. So that's how I saw it.
I concur.
Thanks.
So this is Marta. So if there's how could there be a groundswell that could make it possible, though, so that there could be more money put into a pot somehow about this communication? And as you're saying, Karen, you know, meeting people where they are. Because I think that, you know, from the last call and other calls, too, people, we've all been saying there's enough research, there's enough information, now it's really about...
Or maybe overload.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And how is it, though, that it's not that we need more information, it's that we need to know better how to communicate it and to help make possible more innovative ways to get that communication out into a broader public.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. And this is Caroline Lewis again. I was director of education at Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden for 8 years after being a school teacher and school principal for 22. And I kind of stumbled upon a way to bridge formal and informal education in very profound ways with the Fairchild Challenge program that I'm using now as a model for this Clio Institute, a new nonprofit. And I'll be presenting to this group on November 23rd, so I don't want to be repetitive, but what I was able to do is in 8 years make the agenda of the garden the public school's agenda. And so what I'm trying to do now with this nonprofit, I just left Fairchild in January, and a group of Fairchild people came with me to form this nonprofit, and we are looking to identify and develop these scalable, replicable, and transformative programs that meet these community groups where they are. And, you know, we've got some exciting ideas coming up, but I do think that scalability and different access points for community groups, in addition to lobbyists and government and policy and decision making, what is the term that they use? They triage. You know, we got to do it all. So that's kind of where I'm coming from, and I'm so excited that this group on the phone. I was frustrated in D.C. with some of the NSF folks because they were still pushing the all or nothing science agenda, and I said, yes, you need to do that, but you also need to fund some wide net casting of infusing community groups into thinking and attitudinal changes and embracing and performing and, you know, the whole nine yards. So I'm heartened by the potential of that.
This is Joel Rosenberg from Berkeley. Well, I can say a couple of the things that I've noticed. One, somebody mentioned the limits of federal funding. When PCAST, you know, the PCAST report that came out a month or two ago,
yes.
they have in there a breakdown of the education funding from the major divisions within the federal government. NSF has a $6 billion budget and spends something like $600 million on education. But when you look at the other numbers from the DOE, which has been basically absent from the public, really trying to do serious public education and outreach, I feel like the Department of Energy has not really done much. NIH is almost totally absent as far as climate as a public health issue, or even energy as a public health issue. And so you have NSF, which is pretty much focused on, like, science, education, innovation, and that's not what this is. And, you know, where's the movement? You know, the climate literacy principles are okay, but they're not a movement-inciting document.
Right.
No? So, like, so the question of, like, action, you know, should I replace my refrigerator? How do I get a home audit? How much is it going to cost me? What's the payback period? Nobody's really addressing that on a public. I mean, there are groups like the Association for Energy Efficiency, or other sort of nonprofit groups, but that has not been an educational focus. And this, part of my frustration is the lack of urgency around solving the problem rather than educating the public.
Correct. Yeah, where are the public service announcements? Where are the state level, national level public service announcements? I gotta tell you, I got a traffic ticket. I mean, this is a little off topic, but I got a speeding ticket and I went to traffic school. And we're not seeing the real America. These people are so illiterate and basic and simple, and you know, it can't be just, we have to do it all. And I'm listening to you, Joel, and I am desperate for a sense of urgency. And when Frank sent that rally cry, I love the conversation that came out of it, but Gary said, the movement is on, and I'm going, yo, Gary, the only ones playing in it are us. You know, we're not engaging the middle America.
And there's another piece that we haven't talked about yet, and that's the fact that if you go and do any of the reasonably well-designed ecological footprint or carbon footprint calculators and you minimize everything as much as they allow, you still end up with a footprint that's over two Earths because of the work of government and the fact that the U.S. military is the world's largest user of fossil fuels, and that needs to be part of the conversation somehow, too. I mean, replacing your refrigerator is something I've done, and I think it's important to communicate why you should do that, but it's only a stepping stone towards really wrapping your head around the problem and getting towards solutions.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Can you guys identify yourself when you speak?
Oh, sorry.
This is Joel. I agree with you that, like, refrigerator replacement, as one example, is not going to solve the problem. But neither is just, you know, even if you start building the solar cells the solar plants that people have been building, that's not going to solve the problem either. But the movement is not going to look like the civil rights movement. People are not really going to march over this. And the benefits that they get from changing their power supply and their use are not going to really be, they're not going to be super visible to people or even really exciting. You know, like, if you turn your light on, you don't care where the power comes from. You just care that your light is on. But the education around making this giant change has been so focused on the science of climate across education that people are very far from knowing what personal actions matter, and they're very far from knowing what social collective actions matter.
This is Marta. So I just want to say that for the NIH, that they have now, and some of you may know this better than I, they have a group that is pulling together all in the 26 or 28 or however many institutes in NIH. They're pulling together all the people who are working on climate in some kind of way or another, and that's been happening since last year. And it might be very helpful if we had a... I'm just trying to think about like, solutions, because I think that what everybody's saying, all of it is right. And so if we can figure out, you know, everybody has their own passion of what they think is most important. You know, if each one of us could maybe write up a paragraph or something like that, and then we can get it to the people that can be working on those sectors. So, for example, you know, I'm happy to get to the NIH people. I know some of those folks. I know the Department of Energy is really, because of the military, it's really focused on greening the military, which I think is a wonderful, great thing. And the individual actions, that all matters as well. I think the problem is that we're talking to each other,
mm-hmm.
and what we need to do is to get into these other groups and to talk a little bit more about this sort of estuary place between the climate research and the education and the personal shifts and also systemic shifts, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So the question is really, so how, you know, what would be the action steps for this group to either make the group larger or you know, place people so, you know, to talk to these different groups?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is Joel again, and I guess when I look at the NIH's budget, which is five times NSF's budget, and I look at their education budget, as reported in that PCAST report, and it's like, I think it's like five times less than NSF's.
Mm-hmm.
I say, who in D.C. or who with ties to NIH has some way of, or ties to, you know, Obama or whatever, has some way of harnessing the power of the push for STEM education, harnessing the power of the push for clean energy, and getting... You know, if we can get other agencies to increase their STEM funding, how you get them to leverage that towards this problem, not just looking at old researchers and getting them together to talk about the problem. How do you get new money focused on trying to work on this problem? And that's one example of what I think, what I would like to see more of, but I have very relatively poor connections. But I just sort of throw that out.
Go ahead. This is Marta. I was just going to say, I do know some of the NIH people, and the way that I know them is I went there.
Went to the front door?
I did. I went to the front door. And I threw around as many names as I possibly could go until somebody would see me. And I brought a newspaper article with me that I had found, you know, that they were putting together this group, and I just went there. So now I know people there.
Right.
Good for you. That's the way
it is. It's the only way to go. So I'm happy to be a spy in any of those groups for you if I can get in. But I do know that they really are very, very interested in, and they're very aware. And what it's like, everybody wants to do stuff, but they don't know exactly how to do it. So
right.
People can give me what you would want, and probably the way is not to say new money, because new money, everybody's like, oh my God, we're, you know, we have to cut. But it's rather to shift money.
You're absolutely right.
So if we could do that, then and if somebody would give me a very articulate and wonderful thing to give to the right person, I would be able to do that.
That was
worth it. I
need
need that
you to be at Obama's elbow next month.
Yeah. And the other thing is that there's a third, and probably some of you know this better than I. There's this group of communicators from, or communications people from 13 or so different federal agencies, including NIH and DOE and the Department of Transportation and all these kind of gazillions of people. And I know the guy who's Jason Samenow, who's now actually at the Washington Post, but we could get information into them as well pretty easily. So, and they're all supposed to be communicating about climate change, but they also don't know exactly what to do. So if we can provide them with solutions, they would be happy. and we would be happy.
I think if we look at what schools have done well in terms of building understanding, in a great many ways, it's pretty limited. But most people do graduate from high school knowing basically how to read and write. I don't think they understand much about science or much about history or anything much beyond read and write that predictably associated with the school that they went to, other than the way that it's associated with other factors. But they do know how to read and write, and I think that fundamental to that is because reading and writing goes across the curriculum. And somehow we need to think about how to help get climate to go across the curriculum, and in a way that schools and others buy in, that it's infused into the culture of schools and it's infused into the larger culture, that you always think about climate when you're making a decision.
Well, I think this is Roberta from Kentucky Environmental Education Association. Quality. I think what you're speaking to is really what environmental educators have been talking about for a long time. It's this idea of environmental education, sustainability, climate systems working together, how human and natural systems work together. I keep going back to the environmental literacy plan that we're working on in Kentucky, and I know other states are working on because of hopefully some money will be coming down the pike from the federal government to promote environmental literacy and get environmental education into the schools more. But in a broad sense, that's, I think, what environmental education strives to do. It strives to bring together all of these systems, our constructed systems and our natural systems, and look at how we interact with each other and how one is affected by the other. So from that perspective, there are a lot of environmental education associations that are already on this. I know we are, and we're in Kentucky, where all of our energy comes from coal, so it's sometimes a bit of a challenge, but we're all about trying to get this out the way we can.
Joel again. I'm always the guy talking about energy, and I like climate, but in the 70s there was a lot of energy education with almost no mention of climate, and they worked pretty hard, and they have their historical booklets and stuff that they developed for trying to infuse energy education across the curriculum. And so social studies, you're learning the history of the United States in terms of energy use and global, and they're writing in English and stuff, and so I really feel like that's a somewhat compelling way to do this, and that we tried before that we failed to implement fully back then, and we have sort of lost and replaced it with environmental education. I'm not opposed to environmental education, and I don't think that it seems to me harder to teach. For me, it would be harder to teach American history in terms of the environment than in terms of the energy use.
And I'm going to say real quick that the part of it, I really do believe, this is Roberta again, is unfortunately the politics of our society right now are such that the word environment now conjures certain ideas for some people, and they also see it as something that's separate from ourselves. So I have no trouble at all finding environmental education ties across the curriculum, but from a broad sense, environmental education isn't just about, trees and flowers and things like that. It's of how we interact with our surroundings. But I'm totally in agreement with you as far as the energy education idea. I think there's less politics involved with the idea of energy education. But on the flip side of that, our energy education that's happening in Kentucky, and there's a lot of it going on right now,
through NEED, the National Energy Education Development Project, they don't mention climate hardly at all, because we're in Kentucky.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll disagree with you about the, you know, teaching history through the lens of environment. There are doctoral programs that look at that. Think about water law, and think about the difference between how we think of how we treat water and rights of water east of the Mississippi and west of the Mississippi. So it's not just energy that you can use.
Yeah, but I mean the thing,
historical lens. So that's just kind of that's totally an aside. But the thing is that it's a question of any one of these. If you look at the history of environmental education, and you know, energy education was big in the 70s and the 80s, and then it kind of died off. Same thing for recycling and solid waste. There were, you know, efforts in the 90s for biodiversity education. So, you know, we come and go, and it's a question of, are you talking about a very specific area like climate or biodiversity or energy or solid waste or, you know, fill in the blank, wildlife? Or, you know, I tend to put all of those things under a bigger umbrella of saying that that's environmental education, and that what we really have to do is look at it from a comprehensive, cohesive sort of manner, and that if you are talking about energy, you are also talking about climate, and you are also talking about biodiversity, and you are also talking about all these different interconnected issues.
Yes, and I
was going to say, Bora, this is a question for her. This is Scott Carley. I'm curious whether there's a way of relating environmental literacy or environmental education really to sort of life skills, that what we're teaching, I'm kind of going back to Don's point about how do we develop curricula that really cross all the disciplines, like reading and writing. And is there a way in which we can talk about this as, like, these are the consequences of your actions, or this, you know, a sort of sensitivity around the kinds of things that are happening, you know, from a weather perspective or, you know, phenology or, you know, any other kinds of things that you can actually see, you know, on a day-to-day basis. I mean, is that a way that we can really bring this into the curriculum in a way that really changes actions, quite frankly, because what we're talking about is education that informs those actions rather than something that's kind of separate from it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are some really nice models out there that look, have students learn the skills and really investigate concerns and issues of their own. Look at, you know, if you haven't before, look at the work of Harold Hungerford and Trudy Volk and those folks on issue investigation. And it really does teach those, it teaches those civic skills, and it talks about that, and this is, I think, one of those really important pieces, is that you actually have to teach people how to think about issues and how to investigate issues and how to weigh alternatives and then how to think about what they want to do. It's, you know, we don't teach civics in the schools anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, we don't teach. I mean, we barely teach the three branches of government, and that gets muddled half the time.
Right.
So, you know, my sort of vision is that, yes, the science of it is extremely important, and there's no question about that. But if we don't teach the civics of it, you know, we're going to just have a bunch of, you know, we'll have some people who hopefully will be reasonably scientifically literate, but they won't know what to do with the information.
Right.
Right.
And I think this is Caroline. Just can I just please say that I love this conversation. I agree with everything, but I, with my years of experience with teenagers, I mean, teaching civic skills is tough, but giving them opportunities to engage as members of society is a win-win. And I have to tell you, we have to look at education as giving any audience we're targeting opportunities to engage in that means.
And the one in particular model that I pointed out, the Hungerford and Volk and others involved with it, the students are. They're picking a topic of their choice, they're investigating,
correct,
and they're going all the way through the action. And then they evaluate whether or not their chosen action actually did any good.
Can you give an example of an action?
They might, it may be something as simple, because it's probably fourth grade all the way up through high school. It may be political action, so it may be going and petitioning their government on something. There's a great program out of Molokai. And it's some teachers in Molokai. They now have a private school that they run. Their students choose their own actions. They've gone from Molokai to the state house in Hawaii and spoken before the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it may be small personal actions. It may be taking things home. So recycling, it could be energy, it could be audits, it could be all sorts of different things, or it could be trying to get, you know, their school to change, it could be trying to change things in their community. Looking back to the early 70s, Bill Stapp in Ann Arbor used to do things where the students actually came up with transportation plans of trying to have more bicycling and walkable ways of getting to school. And the kids actually investigated it, figured it out, and took it to the city council. So, you know, it can be all over the place in terms of environmental actions, but the idea is that the kids actually one, they choose the topic that's interesting to them, and then they thoroughly investigate it, come up with an action plan, and then follow through with that action plan.
Yeah. So this is Joel again, and it sounds like it sounds nice, and it sounds good, and it sounds like it's effective, and I'm definitely in favor of kids picking a topic and working through it. But the thing that I keyed in on was when you said the things that they do are all over the place, and sure, in that we have a sort of failure of people to really know what they can do that's effective towards the climate problem. We have a failure of people to know what's effective in terms of social solutions, which isn't to say that bike lanes aren't important, but if none of the kids are talking about, like, the energy infrastructure or the things fall through the cracks. And so I think that what you end up with in that model, and I think it's good, but what do we want everyone to know about what they can do? Like, what's the action about going home and inventorying your windows and your fridge and your light bulbs? And there hasn't been a coherent proposal that I've seen around that. You know, the Department of Energy has some of that. There's not much in schools around that other than, like, schools trying to green themselves. And it's not to say individual teachers aren't doing it. There's not, like, this mandate of, like, we're going to have all the kids do this. And there's not, like, we're going to have all the kids investigate their own energy system and write letters to their local utility. I would like to see more action-oriented, focused things around effective things to do. And it's not that I'm opposed to the kids choosing their own thing. It's that I don't think the kids probably don't know enough to really know. They don't know what's important. They know what's important to them, which is, I'm not degrading that. But as far as the urgency around solving this problem, environmental education hasn't done it. The environmentalists haven't done it. And it's not, I don't blame them. It's certainly not for lack of trying, but there has not yet been enough. How are we going to actually solve this problem? What do we want everyone to actually do to solve the problem? And that's my frustration in education is that.
This is Karen Holwick, and I'd like to combine some of the ideas that you've all thrown out so far and ask an additional question. What I've seen from both program evaluations and from the research is that the identification of an issue that is of concern to students is really key in getting the students involved and engaged in working on it. The other thing that the research shows is that once they've gone through the process of working on an issue, taking action, and evaluating it, those skills are applied repeatedly throughout their lives. And so what's gained is not information. What's gained is a collection of skills and abilities that are continually applied throughout kids' lives. And I think that's a critical component to what Bora was describing. And I think that doesn't happen when an issue or a question is imposed upon a classroom of kids who may never get engaged in it because they don't care about it. The other thing that Caroline pointed out that I think is really critical is the need, several people have used the word culture, and I think the role that many agencies, and I'm thinking right now specifically of Department of Energy, can play is in doing a lot of PSAs and creating the kind of culture, the kind of buzz or whatever you want to call it,
mindset
that puts value on and triggers people to think about the kinds of things that you're talking about, Joel, to really think about the role of energy in their lives. So I think the role of the communications media and the government agencies in setting a tone and a message and a culture and a buzz around all these things that we care about, and the role of schools in developing skills and abilities really need to interact together and are complementary. And I also think that we, all of us, I'm assuming from past conversations, are also interested and concerned about the role of informal education at the mm-hmm. community level with adults and all sorts of other folks. And so I think it's the whole we need to be thinking about and not fall into the trap that schools and local newspapers do, which is say, teachers need to teach kids better. The answer is not just a single faction doing one thing, but I think it's in the whole system working on various parts in a way that interacts.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the key messages of the roundtable, which was encouraging.
Which is what?
Right.
The work on multiple fronts coordinated. It is not, and school has the potential to be a player in making change, but it's not the primary driver. There is no primary driver. A lot of pieces of the system need to be orchestrated if we actually want to make change.
I agree with that. I agree with Karen what you said also, that like trying different outlets. You know, I'm an informal guy, really, so I'm a fan of using museums. Museums have not done very much as a whole around this issue. Individual museums, yes. Schools have not been very coherent. The PSAs from the DOE don't exist, or if they do, it's like unplug your vampire. I've seen an unplug your vampire AC adapters I've seen posters of that from the ad council. So the question that I would have is, if you coordinate and you get everyone on the same page talking about the same thing, what is that thing that everyone is talking about? And that, I think, is what has not been decided.
Well, what do you think it is?
I think it's straight up like you can live a normal life you can live the same life pretty much by wasting a lot less energy in your daily life. And here's how. Insulating your house, you know, I have that effective list of actions, you know, that sort of rank orders what the things that you can do are that would be effective: driving less, carpooling more, and then trying to show people the bigger picture, like here's where your power comes from if you live in, you know, I live in the Bay Area, so PG&E, what's the power mix, okay, you know, in Kentucky, it's all coal, make it more explicit that it's all coal, make it more explicit how much could come from the sun, or how much could come from geothermal, or how much could come from wind, and what other states surrounding you have those resources.
It's very local. I think that that's one part of the answer, if I could say this. I think that some people really resonate with that logical approach, and other people don't. And I think that, and that's what ad agencies know, and that behavior change, it really has to do partly, it has to do partly with sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I mean, what makes it sexy? What makes it cool? What makes it so that you want, I mean, and that's why I think I might have said this in another conversation, you know, like what, love makes us do wild, incredible things. And so it's really, you know, what is it that has a ghetto kid spend $100 on a pair of sneakers? You know, it's not just logic.
Okay,
And the only reason I bring that up is because I think that it's really important in our conversation that we talk about bringing in, it's not just about threading, threading environmental education into all these other topics, history and economics and blah, 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 which I think is really important. It's also important to think about threading history, economics, all these other things into environmental education.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So that's, I just want to just say, what I would love to see this group really focus or think about, too, is what are those things that really make people change?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because we have all the information, but people are not doing it.
I'm not. There's a conference in 2 weeks called Behavior, Energy, and Climate Change.
Right.
And, you know, that it brings. There are not many educators there. There are a lot of psychologists. There are a bunch of academics. And they do focus on that kind of stuff, unlike behavioral economics. Like, people are not rational decision makers.
Right.
And I'm with you. You know, the logic argument will appeal to some people, not to others. What I would really like to see, and it's not, it is greater urgency leading to greater funding to get more people who think about how to communicate, thinking about how to communicate this particular thing, solving the problem. And I'm not opposed to life skills, but really, when you go to, when you hear the scientists who are like, we have 10 years before the problem becomes unsolvable to hit the PPMs that we want.
Yeah.
That is not communicated clearly enough.
Right. I agree that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Caroline, and I agree. If we don't get some of those nuggets articulated, like some of our political parties can reduce things to such a great nugget that everybody gets it. What you just said, whomever you are, about the parts of a million in 10 years, is right on. But I want to encourage this group, based on the round table. And you have links to the articles by Susan Clayton and Elaine Andrews, who spoke to the cognitive, emotional, and behavioral aspects of education, which asks to go beyond logic to engage most of America. And I just want to get this crowd to know that we got some real meaty, good sources that you can quote from on taking this holistic approach to meeting multiple members of diverse communities, you know? And I want bullets too, so.
Where are those links?
You know, when maybe I'll just send it out to you all again. I sent you a ton of stuff from Andrew McRae. Did you all get that? I sent the sheet.
Yeah.
Let me send you Clayton, and you don't have to like any of this, but you keep what you want and you delete the rest. But I think Clayton and Andrews in particular really dealt with the social context of climate change education, kind of succinctly. So I'll do that today.
Great.
And this is Marta, and I will send poking around the internet, I was trying to find that group of the 13 federal agencies that I mentioned before, and it's been renamed to the United States Global Change Research Program, and I'll send everybody that link, because that has those different agencies, and this discussion really should or could be in the midst of every single one of them, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And money could be released also, I think, for this communication aspect. But we could help them to release it.
This is Scott again. I think that's the program that Frank Niepold, who is often on this call, he's part of that group, or
yep.
Closely aligned with them. So he knows this issue, but we can we at least have a lobbyist. Let's put it that way. We can make these points, pass them on to Frank, and he certainly would be very receptive to this idea.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what used to be the Interagency Partnership for Climate Change, or something like that?
It wasn't that. It was that I know of. It was called the Climate Change Science Program.
Yep.
Is that the same thing that you're thinking of?
No, it's not.
Okay.
But Frank is also, I think, co-chair with David Campbell of something that's called something like the Interagency Partnership for Climate Change Education, or.
Yep, that's close.
And Campbell's at NSF.
Yeah, and David Campbell's at NSF. Yeah.
This is Caroline. I just got a link to the Climate Change Education Roundtable speakers. I'm just going to mail you the whole link because you can get the drafts of these people's current writings there, all right? Just so you know.
Thanks, Caroline.
Now what?
Yeah. I want somebody to work on these bullets for me so that I get my talking points down, you know?
Yeah. You know, maybe we're moving into some sort of, writing mode. We talked about this for several weeks. It's really, really important. And I wonder whether we go beyond our call in some ways to capture this idea, and it may be, I don't know, whether we're writing a manifesto, a one-page thing, or talking points, as Caroline has mentioned it. Maybe we really do need to pull some of this stuff together and at least communicate it to the other folks who are part of the Climate Literacy Network, and then encourage them to pass it to their networks and colleagues that they work with. I don't know whether that's something that we should attempt to do, to try to get that small, pithy sort of argument paper.
I think it would be
kind of logic too much.
I think it's important to remember that unfortunately one size won't fit all.
Yeah.
There's only so much that I can say here, being in Kentucky with our legislators as they are paranoid about any encroachment on Cole's territory. I kind of fly under the radar. I do a lot of flying under the radar with my climate change PD workshops that I'm doing. And I have the full support of my director in doing that, as long as I use EE principles, environmental education principles, of providing the tools for people to make their own decisions and not teaching what to think but how to think, that kind of thing. It is a real frustration for me teaching this topic in a state like Kentucky, where we have a huge and very active environmental education community, but a lot of teachers, I think, who are really concerned about the topic as well. But then there's this fear of who's going to get wind of it, and is the money coming from taxpayers, and next thing you know, somebody makes a big stink out of it. So we have to be careful how we tread and how we present our case.
Well, you're right, and I think suggesting behaviors would get you into that kind of potential conflict, but facts won't. Facts won't. I mean, and I really think that everybody can come up with their to-do list to personalize a behavior change that would help the greater good, but I really want some scientific facts that are real but alarming, and they kind of frame whatever access point you're using to interact with community. But everybody, whether it's a change agent or a scholar on the state, they need some common facts that we're all saying repeatedly so that it becomes part of the mindset, and I would welcome those. I'm looking right now at the brochure on our website, the Climate Literacy Essential Principles of, and it's loaded with information, but it's too much. It's not a... go ahead.
The other thing that would be extremely helpful, I feel, is some of the arguments or some of the statements that are made on the skeptic side, that and they refer to certain, you know, well-known naysayers. It would be lovely to have some of those statements that make reference to somebody's so-called work on this topic, and then have a scientist say, no, you know, that's actually not true. What he says is not true, and here's why it's not true, so that we at least can have some basis for conversing with people when they say, well, what about this? I mean, my own boss, cyclical nature of climate, you know, the sun spot cycle, and you know, he starts throwing out all of this stuff, and I really don't know what to come back at.
Mythbusters, we need those Mythbusters to counter.
Yes. I mean, there are
really do.
Websites out there that do that, like Real Climate.
There are, and the ones that I have found, maybe you can put some out on the list, because the ones that I have found tend to be very difficult for me to wade through. They're just a little bit too deep.
Well, I think that says a lot. I mean, this group on the phone here is a very bright group. I could just tell from hearing you all speak. And we can't get through the information. So I think part of the problem is we're so afraid of leaving anything out that our to-do and to-no list become ridiculous. And I'm telling you, if you give me more than 5 nuggets, I'm glazing over.
Yeah.
So
I think there are pretty good sites out there. Like I like Real Climate and the Climate Denier Crack of the Week. Is that the right word that goes after climate? But those sites, I think, are relatively user-friendly for debunking claims of the deniers.
What's that site again? Sorry?
Real Climate.
Real Climate Now.
Okay, thank you.
I'll send it.
Yeah, Real Climate's one, and the other one has got Climate and Crack of the Week, and I don't remember if it's Climate Change. It must be Climate Denier Crack of the Week or something like that. But anyway, if you put in Climate Crack of the Week, you'll find it. And he, each week, debunks some claim made by deniers, and I think it's relatively user-friendly. It's a little condescending. I don't know if it's something you would point somebody that you're fighting with to, but something that you could watch and then use the points raised to argue.
John, that website, I think that website is called Climate Crocs, C-R-O-C-K-S, and it's Climate L Croc of the Week.
Yep.
Peter Schiller. Yep. I'm sure that's it.
Yeah, I'm sure that's it.
Thank you.
But part of this is going to, I think those resources are great, and I look at them sometimes when I try and fight back on that front. But I also think that that fighting on that particular front might not be the right front, and it goes to the point that Joel's raised many times, that maybe we ought to be talking more about energy and also about national security, which somebody else mentioned, how the Defense Department, I think it was Marta, mentioned how the Defense Department is trying to reduce their fossil fuel use substantially. And I think those points are
global inequality
to gain traction with certain audiences, and the most important audiences. I mean, I think that even talking about climate change, people just, think of Al Gore and tune it out completely. Which is really unfortunate, but if you've ever had the fortune of seeing Jim Woolsey, the former CIA director, talk about climate change and energy issues, he gives a very compelling talk from a national security standpoint. And so I think, again, you need to target the message to the audience that you're working with. And, you can go down the climate road, and I think we need to do that with audiences that will engage, and we have a priority to try and engage school kids on that front. but I think that if we actually want to change people's behaviors, and talking about grown-ups, there's a lot of grown-ups who just won't engage in that conversation in any meaningful way.
Yeah. This is Joel again. I'll just add that you talk about love and other intangibles. It doesn't resonate with everyone, but instead of focusing on climate and polar bears, focusing on energy and, like, the billion people who don't have electricity. I think energy is a good way to get in there. I'll also just say that GRIST.org, GRIST.org, has a series called How to Talk to a Climate Skeptic.
Yep.
And it's actually broken out sort of by statements that they might say.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool. GRIST, GRIST?
GRIST.org, and if you think it's called How to Talk to a Climate Skeptic. With Don, it's like playing the point-by-point rebuttal game is not futile, but probably not effective. It's almost certainly not effective for solving the problem. If you can convince people one by one, that's definitely something you should do. But as far as addressing the masses, trying to avoid the controversy and talk about other things too, while also saying, and some people believe in climate, like that could be good enough. And then if people say, well, you know, climate, I have all these problems with climate, it's like, well, what about national security? What about fuel supply? What about the people who don't have access to energy? And then they're like, oh, wait, I'm only prepared to rebut you on climate.
Yeah.
And that point was well made at the conference, I thought, when they said the climate change is a health issue, it is a human rights issue, it's all of these things. You know, so I think you can find multiple access points to hook in your audience. You just got to know who they are and how to go after them.
Right. I'll send also, I can't remember if I sent this before, but I'll send again an article by Dan Kahn at Yale and a bunch of other folks called Fixing the Communications Failure talks about what people think about climate and how exactly what you're saying, Joel, is it's just better to just kind of do a sidestep and say, what about all these other things?
Right. Well, folks, it's the top of the hour. This has been a great conversation.
Yeah.
I hate to end it, but if folks need to leave, this is a good time. And we'll save this till next time. I think now. I'm not.
We never decided about whether we're going to do anything.
No, I agree.
Joel, if I can ask you, this is Caroline Lewis, and please feel free to say no, but Joel, if you could give me 5 nuggets next week when we speak, if you're able to, then you think everybody should know this. I mean, from your vantage point, I mean, just the one you said about the 10-year tipping point, and, I mean, that is something that would resonate with some audiences. And I will be selected, so you do that?
Sure,
and
I will do that.
And this is Marta, I've heard 3 to 5 years, so I'm really happy that there's another 5 years.
Well, so I can say that the guy who really resonated with me, he had these 3 peaks showing, like, the sort of, if we start tomorrow, if we start in a few years, if we start in several years. And he referred to them as the beginner, intermediate, and expert slopes.
Oh, great.
Now, and he's like, right now, even the beginner slope is pretty hard. But if we wait, if you know, to get to this point, it's going to be pretty damn steep.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I could turn everything into an optimistic message, but if you give me the facts from which to go, like that graph, that one graph can give me a 45-minute talk, you know.
Yeah,
so,
I'll give it a little thought. I'll send it out with a couple of references.
Thank you so much.
Sure. That's great, Joel.
Thanks, everybody.
All right, bye-bye.
Thanks so much for
this.
Thank you. And we'll talk next week, I hope.
Okay.
All righty.
Bye.
All right.
Appreciate it. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.